From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we conclude our two-day series, When and How Should the U.S. Get Out of Iraq? We'll ask Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who served as Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell and has become a critic of the Bush administration and the war, William Kristol, the neoconservative writer and editor who called for regime change in Iraq even before 9/11, Carl Canetta, the co-director of the Project on Defense Alternatives, Yanar Mohammed, an Iraqi women's rights activist, and Lawrence Wright, the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda, and the Road to 9/11. When and how should we get out of Iraq? Coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we conclude our two-part series, When and How Should the U.S. Get Out of Iraq? We're hearing from military leaders, prominent Iraqis, policy analysts, and journalists. Our first guest today is Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. He was the Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell. Wilkerson left the State Department at the same time Powell did, in January 2005. But unlike Powell, Wilkerson became an outspoken critic of the Bush administration and the war in Iraq. He's currently teaching part-time at the College of William and Mary and George Washington University. Lawrence Wilkerson, welcome to Fresh Air. Where did you stand on the invasion of Iraq?
That's a good question. In that time, I was so caught up in the resolution we had gotten in the UN Security Council, 15-0, by the way, in November of 2002, and all the diplomacy leading up to the final failure of our UN efforts in January, that I really didn't have a whole lot of time to think about it. I felt like Iraq had violated a number, 16, 17 UN Security Council resolutions. I felt like containment was failing, the sanctions were failing. I felt like Saddam Hussein at some time, once the sanctions were lifted, would go back to making his weapons of mass destruction again, and that eventually we would have to do something about him. So I suppose I'd have to say that once the diplomacy failed, I was probably in favor of using force to remove him from his position.
And has the war turned out the way you expected?
Not at all. I did not know, nor do I think my boss, Secretary Powell, knew that we would be so inept in the aftermath of what was very furious and fast military action. We would see the statue come down, for example, in Baghdad, and then things would go so badly. Barbara Bodine, then referred to as the mayor of Baghdad, Ambassador Barbara Bodine, put it this way. She said, "I knew there were 500 ways to get it wrong and maybe one or two to get it right. I did not know that we'd do all 500.
What about getting out? Do you think it's time to get out now? And if not now, when?
I think it's inevitable that we have to get out, and we have to get out sooner rather than later. And when I say get out, I mean the preponderant number of American forces. And I say that for two really good, I think, strategic reasons. One, we're malpositioned right now with so many 160,000 or so boots on the ground in Iraq to protect our other vital interests in the Middle East. Those vital interests include the security of Israel, the flow of oil through the Strait of Hormuz, the flow of oil through the pipelines, Turkey, and so forth. The second strategic reason is that we are, in essence, adding to our problems by having so many American boots on Arab soil. It is one of the, if not the, leading, that in Guantanamo Bay, leading incentives for recruitment by organizations like al-Qaeda. So we need to get our boots off Arab soil. We need to get better positioned so we can protect our real interests in the Middle East. Better positioned means over the horizon, carrier battle groups, marine amphibious groups. It means pre-positioned stocks and exercises. It does not mean boots on Arab soil.
And when do you think we should pull out our troops?
I think we're going to have to begin in the summer of this year, and we're probably going to have a considerable portion, I'd say somewhere 30, 40,000, maybe even 50,000 gone very shortly thereafter, say December, January. And that's simply because we are breaking the backs of our Army and Marine Corps, who of course are taking the brunt of this, by the continual deployments, the continued separations, the continued tasking of the institutional fabric of those two services in order to provide this number of troops overseas.
When it comes to pulling the American troops out of Iraq, do you think that we should be looking for certain benchmarks before we leave, or do you think it's time to just start moving troops out?
I think this is a sad thing to say, but I think we've passed the time for benchmarks, actually. I think the dimensions of the problem we have with our land forces, the gravity of the situation of our being malpositioned to protect our other interest, Afghanistan and its kind of going to hell, and the need to right that situation, and other matters are going to cause us to come out regardless. So to talk about benchmarks, in my view, let's hope that benchmarks line up with that inevitability. Let's hope there's peace and stability reasonable. Let's hope there's a little bit of economic turnaround in Iraq. Let's hope the oil is flowing. Let's hope all those things coincide with our leaving. But we're going to have to leave, ultimately, at any rate.
Now, Iraq's defense minister said this week that Iraq wouldn't be able to take responsibility for its internal security until 2012 and wouldn't be able to defend its borders on its own until 2018. So how do you take that into account when deciding when and how to pull out? What responsibility do we have to Iraq to help Iraq defend itself from outside enemies and to help prevent civil war from within?
Well, frankly, that's a preposterous statement. It's an understandable statement, but it's nonetheless preposterous. Iraq could handle most of the external threats to it right now if it congealed around some form of national government and wielded the army it has, the police forces it has, and so forth in a reasonably concerted way. So that's a preposterous statement. It's understandable from the perspective of this is a gentleman and there are gentlemen arrayed around him, mostly gentlemen, not gentlewomen, who feel like their interests are protected by the fact that U.S. forces are there and feel like that their interests might be threatened not by some external threat, but by some internal threat were we to leave. And so that's the reason that prompts him to make such statements.
You're saying the government is defending itself with that statement?
I'm saying that there are certain people in the government who have more to fear from a U.S. departure should the Sunni, for example, decide that it's time to have a real civil war than others do. And they would, of course, want us to stay.
Now, you were a colonel in the Army. Do you think the surge is being effective in quieting things in Iraq and creating a more stable Iraq and in paving the way for political reconciliation and a political infrastructure?
It is, but it had already started. The surge was just incidental to it already starting and helped to consolidate it. What had happened was a number of things. We had begun some really robust combat operations in early 2007, which were coming to fruition. One of the things that manifested itself from those combat operations was the Sunni insurgents largely understanding that they were going to get licked. And so they began to be more conducive to working with the coalition, to accepting training, to accepting arms, to appearing to being aligned with the coalition until they could find better things to do. That's one of the things that happened. Very robust combat operations beginning in early 2007. Another thing that happened was that Muqtada al-Sadr, who controls the most powerful Shia militia in Iraq, went to ground. Now, there are various reasons that people speculate as to why he did this, but nonetheless, he did it. And so that took a lot of the violence and potential for violence away. I think Iran has recalculated what an unstable Iraq might mean to it and has toned down its support and arming of Shia groups and its support for instability in Iraq in general. And I think the Kurds have decided that the operations that are ongoing against the PKK in their midst are conducive to their continued stability and prosperity. And you begin to put some of these things together, many of which, if not all, began to happen before the surge, and you understand why we have not a situation of peace, certainly, and not a stable situation either, but we have a little more stability and a little less violence now.
What do we owe to the Iraqi people before we pull out? Like, what degree of stability, what degree of safety, what degree of electric power do we owe them before we leave?
I prefer not to look at it that way because I don't think that's a very realistic way to look at it. I prefer to look at it the way I assume General Petraeus is looking at it. We should have been letting the Iraqis deal with many of these challenges far earlier than we did. I think that's one of the reasons General Petraeus has been able, as I said, to consolidate the positive impacts of what's happened in Iraq in 2007. He's turning more and more responsibility over to the Iraqis. So the question is not what do we owe the Iraqis before we leave, it's what they owe to themselves. Can they reconcile to the point that they get a petroleum sharing agreement through the parliament? Can they bring about reconciliation enough to the extent that they can get outside the green zone and begin to see a little more of their country? Can they bring the kind of prosperity economically and otherwise to their people that needs to be there in order to dissuade them from further violence? These are the kinds of questions that the Iraqis are going to have to answer. We can't answer these questions for them. For 4 years, we thought we could, and that's part of our problem.
You were responsible for a review of information from the CIA that was used to prepare Secretary of State Colin Powell's speech before the UN Security Council in February 2003, in which he made the argument that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. And you've said that every time you took something out of his speech that you didn't think really held up, that the vice president put it back in.
that's not exactly what I said. I said there were key components of the script that was given us largely by the vice president's office that we discarded, that stayed discarded. And there were others, like, for example, the meeting allegedly between Baghdad's people and al-Qaeda's people in Prague, Czechoslovakia, that we threw out that kept coming back. That one in particular was put back in several times until General Powell, Secretary Powell, finally grew adamant and said that's out and it's staying out. More to the point, the 48-page script on WMD that we got from the vice president's office, DCI Tenet, George Tenet and I, agreed with the secretary's, of course, approval to throw out completely because it was essentially a useless document. The document prepared in the vice president's office for the secretary's use at the UN was a useless document. And we went to the October 2002 National Intelligence Estimate and used it instead. Unfortunately, of course, as we all know now, major components of it were wrong, too.
Since you were given data that turned out not to be accurate, are you skeptical of any data the American people are being given now by the Bush administration about how the war in Iraq is doing?
I'm not skeptical, but I'm not not skeptical for the reasons you're implying. I'm not skeptical because I have many military, diplomatic, even contractor and other friends in Iraq who email me routinely. And I have several individuals whom I had a hand in putting there in late 2003, for example, who've worked everywhere from the Iraqi ministries to Minsticky to working for General Petraeus and training the Iraqis originally to working in the current organization involved at the spearhead of the surge. And I rely on their information more than I do the administration's information. And right now, I don't find a lot of difference between their information and what the administration is putting out, except there may be possibly a little more positive spin on the administration's information.
But there were earlier times when you did see a discrepancy?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Particularly when people like Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld were saying it's not an insurgency, it's not guerrilla warfare, or people like Vice President Cheney were saying, I think we're in the last throes. That was preposterous. People in Iraq were telling me, military and civilian, that we were losing, and that we were losing badly.
You were Colin Powell's chief of staff when he was Secretary of State. I'm wondering if you have any idea whether the president or the vice president has any second thoughts about the war in Iraq.
Oh, I can't imagine they don't. I just can't imagine they don't. I would have to attribute to them a degree of obtuseness and ignorance unparalleled, not to think that they don't have second and third and even fourth thoughts about Iraq. The president can insist, and he must do so, I suppose, publicly, particularly to the right wing in the Republican Party, that his principles are being followed, he'll be vindicated, and so forth and so on. But I would venture to say he probably has a little problem sleeping at night.
Any final thoughts you'd like to leave us with?
Just that Clausewitz, my mentor and theorist of war par excellence, had a lot to say about war, as most of my colleagues know in the military. One of the things he said that was quite clear was that anytime you embark on using your people, your young people, to kill other people for state purposes and risk their own lives in the process, you better be darn sure you know what you're doing before you start it. I don't see us having done that for a long time, and I would really like to see us elect some people who know how to do that.
Lawrence Wilkerson, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson was Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell. Coming up, neoconservative writer and editor William Kristol. This is Fresh Air. We're asking a range of military leaders, prominent Iraqis, policy analysts, and journalists, when and how should the U.S. get out of Iraq? Our next guest is William Kristol, a neoconservative who advocated regime change in Iraq even before September 11th. Crystal is the editor and co-founder of the Washington-based political magazine, The Weekly Standard. This month, he became a columnist for The New York Times. William Crystal, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's just start with a very brief summation of where you stood on the invasion of Iraq.
I supported the liberation of Iraq.
And you were one of the people leading the charge, is that fair to say?
Lots of people were leading the charge, but I was certainly part of it.
So now, do you think it's time to pull out? And if not now, when?
It's certainly not time to pull out. We changed strategy a year ago, and that strategy has worked. The country is much more secure. Deaths of all kinds are way down. We're seeing political reconciliation. We need to stay the course. We're unwinding the surge itself. Obviously, we're withdrawing about a brigade a month here for the first half of 2008. But the U.S. troops were necessary and essential to providing security for the Iraqis, to providing confidence to the Iraqis to turn against al-Qaeda and also against the Shia extremists, which they've done. The point isn't to pull out. The point is to have Iraq be a success. We're going to end up leaving some troops there, I think, to help them for quite a while. And it's a practical judgment about whether that's, 40,000 or 60 or 80. I obviously can't say right now. But I would not make the objective pulling out. I'd make the objective success. And then I would obviously draw down troops and draw back troops from fighting, if that's possible, consistent with making sure that there's enough security for the political process to move forward.
Part of General Petraeus's approach to cutting down sectarian fighting in Iraq was to actually pay some sheikhs and militia leaders, Sunni sheikhs and militia leaders. And that's been an effective strategy for the moment, but some people wonder, after we leave, might some of the people who we've been paying to stop fighting start fighting again, or might sectarian fighting start again? Are you concerned about that?
Well, obviously, no one can say that it's not possible that the sectarian violence could increase again. There will be, I'm sure, spurts of increase. But as long as the long-term trend is decrease, I think that's what we want. Look, we're not going to leave. I mean, people keep saying after we leave, but it's probably not going to be a nation that we can just walk away from any more than Bosnia and Kosovo have been situations where the Europeans and us have been able to walk away from it, 10 years now after that intervention. Some level of U.S. support, both political and probably military, is going to be needed to reassure the Iraqis that the worst sectarian actors, the worst terrorists aren't going to be allowed to prevail.
The main reason for the surge was to create a peaceful and stable environment that would enable political progress to move forward and enable Iraq to really start creating a political infrastructure. Do you feel like the surge has been succeeding on that level?
Sure. I mean, it's on the ground, there's kind of an amazing amount of reconciliation, or at least accommodation. I'm not going to pretend that people there love each other any more than people in lots of parts of the world love each other. The key is for them to decide they're not going to resolve their disagreements by killing each other or slaughtering each other, and that seems to be happening. They're not killing or slaughtering each other. They're trying to work things out politically. It'll be a highly decentralized nation, which is probably a good thing. But now I think the benchmark legislation that people have been so focused on probably has been a mistaken focus in the sense that that matters less than what's happening at the ground level. But now the Iraqi parliament has passed the de-ba'athification law. It looks like they're going to pass some form of revenue sharing. So clearly the political process is moving ahead. And look, it could get tougher again. These things don't go in one direction in one straight line. But the degree of progress in the last 3, 4, 5 months, both military and political, has been pretty astounding, I think.
Some people say that part of the reason why violence has quieted down in Iraq is that some cities have virtually been ethnically cleansed. For instance, Shia have driven out Sunnis in many areas, and many Sunnis have fled the country. But the question has been raised, when Sunnis are ready to return to Iraq and they find that their homes and their neighborhoods are now occupied by Shia, then what? And I wonder if you've given any thought to that question.
A little bit. I'm no expert on exactly how to manage that, and it's going to have to be done, obviously, in a somewhat case-by-case and area-by-area basis. There's been some ethnic cleansing, unfortunately, because we didn't surge earlier, because we let the situation get out of control. But the good news is that this is the problem we're facing, that Sunnis want to come back and figure out how to, you know, reincorporate themselves into Iraq. And it's going to require some negotiations and some accommodations. But I think the problem of dealing with people wanting to come back to a peaceful Iraq is a problem that I'm happy to have our government work on, as opposed to the problem of dealing with escalating sectarian violence.
Do you think that the United States will be leaving Iraq a better place than it found it?
Yes. Sure. They'll be able to govern themselves freely and free of a horrible dictator who killed hundreds of thousands of people. It'll be a peaceful ally of the U.S. In the Middle East, I think, a force for good in the region. It's become very fashionable to mock those of us who hope that Iraq could become something of a model. Obviously, it's been very difficult, but the truth is, it looks like we're going to end up in Iraq with a democratically elected government, with Shia and Sunni and Kurds working together in a reasonably constructive way. That's a pretty big accomplishment, not so much for us, but for the Iraqis, I think, and for the Middle East, And I think people are still much too quick to minimize the medium and long-term implications of that in the Middle East. The other countries will look around and see that it can work, and I think that's a very healthy thing.
Well, Bill Kristol, thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry.
William Kristol is the co-founder and editor of the Weekly Standard. This month, he became a columnist for the New York Times. Our series, How and When Should the U.S. Get Out of Iraq, continues in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com. From the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, celebrating 10 years of support for the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we keep asking, when and how should the U.S. get out of Iraq? We'll hear from Carl Canetta, co-director of the Project on Defense Alternatives, Yanar Mohammed, an Iraqi women's rights activist, and Lawrence Wright, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're concluding our two-day series in which we've been asking when and how should the U.S. get out of Iraq. Our guests include military leaders, prominent Iraqis, policy analysts, and journalists. Our next guest, Carl Canetta, is the co-director of the Project on Defense Alternatives. Before that, he was a research fellow at the Institute for Defense and Disarmament Studies and edited its journal, Defense and Disarmament Alternatives. Carl Canetta, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with where you stood on the question of invading Iraq. Were you for it or against it?
From the beginning, I thought that the invasion was unnecessary from a security perspective, unwise from a strategic perspective, and illegal.
Well, do you think it's time to pull out now? And if not now, when?
You know, practically speaking, the idea of immediate withdrawal doesn't translate into something that would actually occur. I think we could decide to withdraw within a six-month period, a year, 18 months. All of those are feasible, but technical practicalities put this into the future. Given that, I think that we can do all that needs to be done positively within the next 12 to 15 months, and our aim should be to withdraw beginning now with the announcement of a timeline for withdrawal.
When you say do what needs to be done, do you mean just logistically in terms of pulling out, or do you mean accomplish what we need to accomplish in Iraq before we pull out?
Logistically, the requirements are much shorter. If we had to leave and we wanted to leave safely and at a not too hurried pace, that could be accomplished in 6 months. But I think we need to think about withdrawal as providing leverage for positive change. It is a way of transforming the political calculus of all the actors in the area. We should use that to help stabilize the situation and reduce the possibility of increased conflict once we leave.
Well, give me an example of how you think we can use a deadline as leverage.
Well, one thing that we can see in the Sunni areas, although the administration and General Petraeus have been able to bring in some of the tribal elements and some of the Sunni insurgents in an effort to isolate al-Qaeda in Iraq, others continue to resist, including the largest of the insurgent organizations. They have been in conversations with commanders on the ground, our commanders, and again they return to the simple point that they cannot and will not cooperate with the United States until it is clear to them that we are leaving. So that's one very important objective, would be to bring them into the fold, but it requires a clear timeline for withdrawal, something that is credible.
Are you concerned that if the United States pulls out in a year or a year and a half, that Iraq will end up in a civil war?
Iraq's already involved in pretty substantial civil conflict, and though we've been able to reduce some types of violence over the past year, I think our present stance is really not sustainable, and it doesn't fundamentally change the opposition in Iraq. In fact, what we find ourselves doing today is arming one side while simultaneously supporting the other. That's really not a solution. It's not a long-term solution. If we left precipitously, I think there's no doubt in my mind that there would be a surge in violence. How bad it would be is impossible to say. We need to make provisions to reduce that probability, and I think that requires us to reach out to other actors in the region. What we lack in Iraq is a ground legitimacy. We don't have the power to move the people that need it to be moved. The most powerful man in Iraq, Ayatollah Sistani, will not speak to us. We need to bring in other actors, and that requires reaching out across the borders to all of the frontline states and to involve them more substantially in the future. They have a stake. They do not want to see Iraq fragment, and they do not want to see a civil war which might portend regional conflict. So we need to use the lever of our leaving to bring in other actors and hopefully to play a more positive role than they have in the past.
Do you think the surge has been effective? And if so, how should we capitalize on it?
I think that the surge has been effective to the extent that all of us are now talking about the surge, as though the addition of a small percentage of additional troops transformed the situation there. I think what has been effective has been the decision to reach out to local Sunni authorities, tribal authorities, to bring them into the fold. It's required devolving authority to them. In fact, we are paying and arming them. That brought them into the fold and dramatically reduced violence in Anbar province. And we've also successfully pushed Muqtada al-Sadr into adopting a truce. I think these were the two principal things that reduced violence in the area. Beyond that, however, I think the surge is a stopgap measure. We cannot We cannot sustain troop levels. And at any rate, what we have not done is transform the situation there fundamentally. This is not the first surge. We've had a number of surges in the past, and in every case, the decision to increase and concentrate troops always brings about a temporary recession and violence. But it has not, and it will not, bring about a fundamental change in the society, which is what we're talking about.
One of the goals of the surge was to create a stable environment so that the political process could move forward. Do you think that the political process has been moving forward in a meaningful way?
I don't think we've seen substantial progress, and I think what we are seeing presently is cosmetic progress. Within the past week, the change in the law regarding de-bathification has finally been adopted by the parliament there. This law has been kicking around for some time, and the objective was to induce Sunnis to see the new order as more inviting to them. But the de-bathification change, it's too late and it's too little. And I think that that characterizes most of the progress that we've seen, that in fact we are not yet at a point where any of the principal actors feel compelled to be realistic. We are a shield. Our presence there is a shield against realism.
So what you want to do, what you recommend doing, is giving the Iraqis a deadline saying, this is when we're withdrawing, so get your act together. If we did that, if we followed your plan, what, if any, kind of military presence do you think the United States should leave behind?
I think our presence should be, our long-term presence should be a minimal one. It should be embedded in a different multinational arrangement, one that is centered on a UN mission and involving, for the most part, Arab and Muslim forces. There's already several proposals to do this. We've been able in the past, we did in the first Persian Gulf War, pull together a fairly large contingent of Arab forces. Within that context, I think the United States and others, other members of NATO, perhaps even Russia, could play a role in training and in helping the Iraqis develop the logistics structure they need. But I think our footprint should be quite small, in the range of a few thousand troops, and those also required to protect our embassy. And that the most important thing is that the context be not a U.S. mission, but a mission that is more broadly based and hopefully viewed both in Iraq and in the region as having greater legitimacy.
Can we talk about logistical considerations for a moment? What Sure. would be the most difficult parts of withdrawing the troops and the tanks and other equipment that we have in Iraq?
Well, the most difficult circumstance would be a withdrawal under fire. We would hope, and I think an objective would be to use the announcement of withdrawal and prior negotiations around withdrawal as a way of bringing as many insurgents into a truce as possible so that they, rather than impede, they facilitate a safe withdrawal of U.S. forces. So that's not a logistics consideration, but it's what's got to concern us the most. The second concern is what is the immediate objective? I think the immediate objective is to move our forces over the border. If we think about how long will it take to bring them home to the United States, that's longer than 6 months. But the key thing is to move them over the border. And then what do we move? Clearly troops, clearly armored vehicles, ammunition stores. Do we need to move everything? Well, presently, we have a stockpile of 2.7 million candy bars. I can think of much better uses than shipping them back home. Moving the number of vehicles that we have, about 45,000, driving them down out of Iraq into Kuwait will create traffic jams. It's important to secure those routes and to do this in a phased fashion. What we don't want to do is to have a long line of vehicles vulnerable to fire for a long period of time. So we leave in bursts, that might mean trying to pull out perhaps two brigades a month would be feasible. Presently, we rotate about the equivalent of one brigade a month. So this is not too much more than what we're already doing.
Carl Canetta, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Carl Canetta is the co-director of the Project on Defense Alternatives. Coming up, Iraqi women's rights activist Yanar Mohammed. This is Fresh Air. Yesterday and today, we've been asking our guests when and how should the U.S. get out of Iraq. Our next guest, Yanar Mohammed, is an Iraqi women's rights activist. In 2003, after the fall of Baghdad, she co-founded the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq, which she now directs. She was raised in Iraq, moved to Canada in 1993, and since 2003 has divided her time between Iraq and Ontario. She returned from her latest trip to Baghdad a couple of weeks ago. She cut the trip short because of threats against her. Yanar Mohammed, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's start out with you very briefly stating what your position was on the invasion.
I was in total rejection of this occupation because we could see beforehand that it will take away the civility from our lives. A military invasion cannot but destroy your life and bring out the worst in the society, and it did.
Do you think the United States should pull out now, and if not now, when?
I think the United States should pull out immediately because the more we are subject to military situations, the worse we are and the more attractive our cities are for all the mujahideen coming from all over the world to fight this, what they call the big evil, which is the United States Army.
Now, the last time you were on our show, you talked about how women were being kidnapped and held for ransom, and how in many areas, women not only had to wear the veil now in Iraq, they had to wear the veil of the militia that controlled their neighborhood, kind of like wearing the right gang colors. If the United States pulls out now, does that stand to help or hurt the cause of women's rights? Will it empower militia leaders if the United States pulls out now? Will it empower Islamic fundamentalists who demand that women wear the veil?
As long as the United States Army is staying in Iraq, it has already empowered all the Islamist factions and it has handed over the power to them. They feel very free to walk around the streets and to oppress women the way they like. And they have multiplied in ways where they have now militias, they have gangs, they have self-acclaimed vigilantes who feel very free to kill whichever woman they find unveiled in the streets. And this happens under the blessings and the existence of the U.S. Army. Why? Because they say it's democracy. They will not interfere with what's happening in the Iraqi streets.
You got back a couple of weeks ago from a month-long visit to Baghdad. How do you think the surge and the successes that it has had has affected women in Iraq?
Well, you know, the very much celebrated surge in Iraq and the relative security that it has created was something that the U.S. government over-celebrated. In Iraq, we are desperate to have some security, and it would make me very happy to tell you that this surge was successful. But in reality, this surge was only arming and supporting one extra militia, which is Sunni, which is made of the tribes of the Sunni Arabs in some parts of the suburbs of Baghdad and the Sunni Triangle. And these are some of the worst places for women and the worst groups to empower in Iraq. So what happened in the last 2 weeks, again, a rise of violence, an increase in the number of explosions, and women, their situations are as bad as they used to be. Actually, in the southern cities of Basra and Umara, the levels of women's killings did rise to levels that were unprecedented, and they are still rising, and nothing is being done about it.
As part of the surge, the United States has paid people who were Sunni insurgents and Sunni militia leaders to put down their arms and stop fighting. This was an attempt to stop the sectarian fighting. And by many reports, that has had a lot of success. Are you saying that some of the people who we've been paying to put their arms down now are actually some of the same people who are the most repressive of women?
Yes, they are. The Sunni tribal heads in their parts of Iraq, the young girls are not allowed to education. Multiple marriages is something common that happens every day. This is the group which was empowered. And if we're discussing about was it a good solution, I take you to the root of the problem. The original policy was to divide Iraqis into Sunnis and Shiites. And later on, when the Shiites became stronger by the American and the Iranian and the other countries' support, the Americans decided to empower the Sunnis. So the question here is, why divide in the first place if you don't want to conquer? Why empower one group and wait for them to kill the other group and then empower the second group? Well, the only natural consequence to that is that the second group will be killing the first group and the sectarian conflict will go on and on. The whole political formula was wrong, was a big mistake, dividing Iraqis upon religious and sectarian lines. Why couldn't the division has been on political lines, like in the United States, like anywhere in the world where you have the right-wing conservative parties, the left-wing leftist parties, and the center? Why did it have to be on religious, sectarian, and ethnic lines? If it explains one thing, it explains that the U.S. right administration look at Iraqis in a racist way.
When the United States does eventually leave Iraq, would you like to see any military forces stay behind?
If there are any military forces, we prefer them not to be American, to be multinational forces of neutral nature, and we know that is very difficult. If you ask me, I prefer to stay with the Iraqi forces, and the coming round of election may help us to kick out some of the bad figures or the bad movements that have come into Iraq, and there should be no more U.S. military existence in Iraq.
What makes you think the death toll will decrease when the Americans pull out?
It will not decrease immediately. But the death toll of women is, it matches the empowerment of the Islamic parties in Iraq. If the Islamic parties and the tribal groups are strong, the killings of women are more. If the Islamic groups feel threatened and they are weaker, the killings will be less. If the healthy political dynamics are supported in Iraq, the leftist side of the society will become stronger, the killings of the women will not be allowed to stay, and the Islamists will become weaker. The U.S. troops have to leave and have to let these natural dynamics take place in Iraq.
Are women represented in the Iraqi government now, and is there a proportion in the Iraqi parliament set aside for women?
In the last round, the proportion was 25% representation of women, which is a very good number. But the problem was, in this first round, it was quantitative representation. Half of them came from Islamist parties, and they all voted against women's rights, and they do not even acknowledge women's issues and equality. So we do not know whether in this coming election we can maintain the proportion of 25%. But we will definitely push for it. And maybe this time some of us women activists, egalitarian women activists, let's call it, can make their way.
Younar Mohammed, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry, very much for having me here.
Younar Mohammed co-founded and directs the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq. Coming up, Lawrence Wright, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. This is Fresh Air. When and how should the U.S. get out of Iraq? That's what we've spent the past couple of days asking. We conclude our series with Lawrence Wright, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda, and the Road to 9/11. He's also a staff writer for The New Yorker and is on the Council for Foreign Relations. Lawrence Wright, welcome back to Fresh Air. When do you think we should get out of Iraq?
We should get out of Iraq when the Iraqis asked us to leave. You know, I was opposed to going into the war, and now I find myself in the miserable spot of being opposed to withdrawing, at least anytime soon. I think that we've done so much damage to that nation that we have a moral obligation to do some repair work. There's also the danger that we've created by creating a new sanctuary for Al-Qaeda, and we have to be very on guard about that.
You say you want to leave when Iraqis say they want the U.S. to leave, but which Iraqis? I'm sure Iraqis are very divided on it. I know the Iraqis and Iraqi-Americans that we're interviewing don't have one point of view. So what would you propose doing to find out what the Iraqi opinion is?
Well, if you take a poll in Iraq, they would say leave. And if you ask individual Iraqis, they would say leave, but not now. Even Muqtada al-Sadr, probably the chief anti-American propagandist on the Shiite side in that country, proposed a bill before Parliament that would have America leave, but not now.
You've written a history of al-Qaeda leading up to September 11th. You know, when it comes to Iraq, you hear arguments on both sides when it comes to terrorism that if we get out, well, that's a victory for the terrorists. But if we stay, that's a great target for the terrorists and a great recruiting ad for the terrorists. The Americans are occupying Iraq. They're still in Iraq. Go get them. So how do you weigh those two ways of looking at leaving and staying?
Both of those things are true, Terry. If we withdraw precipitously, no doubt Iraq will become a haven for al-Qaeda, and al-Qaeda will trumpet it. Look what they did with Afghanistan. I mean, it became, you know, the banner that they defeated one of the superpowers, and now the other superpower is losing. Or if we stay, we continue to be a rallying point for jihadis from all over the Muslim world. But the truth is that right now, al-Qaeda is losing in Iraq. And this is a real crisis of identity for that organization. They thought that when the Democrats won in the congressional elections, that they would soon see the Americans withdrawing. And what followed was a surge, which was very confusing.
Why is al-Qaeda in Iraq losing? Is it because of the surge?
I think the surge has made a real difference. I think the fact that a number of the tribal chiefs in the Sunni areas of Iraq who have started giving their allegiance to the Americans, that's an indication they know which way the wind is blowing. They wouldn't be doing it if they thought al-Qaeda was going to win.
Well, you know, you raise the part of the surge that is a program to pay Sunni militia leaders to stop fighting the insurgency and fight al-Qaeda in Iraq, basically join the team of the Americans. From your assessment, looking at the history of al-Qaeda and the blowback from things that were done wrong, what do you think of that program, and are there risks involved with it?
Well, there are terrible risks. I mean, everything we've done so far has been poorly calculated, starting with the invasion of Iraq, which, you know, if you look at al-Qaeda's internal memoranda, their diaries and so on, they admit that 80% of their membership was captured or killed after a Tora Bora battle in 2001. Al-Qaeda was essentially dead. The war on terror was over. It was the invasion of Iraq that breathed life back into that monster. And now it has a sanctuary there. Now it has a place to operate. And the danger in arming the Sunnis is that you're perhaps arming them for a potential civil war with the Shiites once we withdraw. And that is a real danger. It's one of the reasons the Shiites are so wary of this whole program.
So getting back to something you were saying earlier, the United States should withdraw from Iraq only when the Iraqi people are ready for us to withdraw and when they say it's time. How do you propose finding out, monitoring what the opinion is in Iraq? Like, what should our benchmarks be?
Whether the refugees return. Some are coming back now, not in great numbers, but there is a trickle of refugees returning, and that may in itself be destabilizing because they may be going to homes or neighborhoods that have been occupied by other people now, and that could be a very destabilizing element. But The return of the refugees, I would put at the top of the list as an indication that people feel like it's safe to go home again. The oil law is a critical factor in resolving the political disputes that would create the new Iraq. And until that law is passed, then I think we can't assume that we're making any political progress in that country.
And the oil law is?
The oil law would decide how the National Trust, this tremendous reservoir of oil that the Iraqis are sitting upon, how that will be appropriated among the people or the different provinces. Right now, that's very much up in the air.
And what else? What other benchmarks?
I think as a police force and an army that is ethnically integrated and that will act in the interest of law, if we achieve that, then the Iraqis would be able to enforce stability themselves and without our help. And that's our ultimate goal.
Lawrence Wright, thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Lawrence Wright is the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11, and is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Our series, When and How Should the U.S. Get Out of Iraq, was produced by Monique Nazareth. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, supporting educational, cultural, and environmental initiatives to make our world more livable. On the web at grdodge.org. From the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. And from Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching, at breakthroughcollaborative.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In the heat of the night.
The 40th anniversary edition of the Sidney Poitier classic In the Heat of the Night is now out on DVD. On the next Fresh Air, Poitier talks about the film and more. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
In the heat of...